love that's pure. It don't make no false claim. Intercedes for you instead of casting your blame. Well, not this.
So what's your story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I am your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of very gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, and you hear him with Floyd the Wonder Dog, capital W, capital D, and Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are really great storytellers in their own right. Rounding out our team are our chief production engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin, and our intern, Tatiana Gago. Okay, I have to tell you, it took me about a year to learn how to pronounce Rocherlin. Did I do okay, Nicole?
Of course you did. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story right here on the radio. Stories take us on a journey where we begin to experience the world within the storyteller's paradigm. Reading from Wikipedia's definition of a story, quote, "Every culture has its own stories or narratives which are shared as a means of entertainment, education, cultural preservation, or instilling moral values." Tonight, we are going to hear some special stories that touch on all of those points for this final day of Black History Month. Last week, we listened to Greg Audell and his guest, Desmond Pertrand Bitts, Executive Director of Houston's Buffalo Soldier Museum, to celebrate the stories of the Buffalo Soldiers in the United States. I listened to it. And I've actually played the podcast again a couple of times. I encourage our audience to do so also. Tonight, we're going to continue our theme of Black History Month, but this time we will focus on the stories of Black women physicians in the U.S. I have invited an African-American female physician and an African-American medical student to be on the show tonight. Dr. Tanya Mosley. Okay, I'm working on these pronunciations of my best friend's names. It's bad. Okay, Dr. Tanya Mosley is a diagnostic radiologist at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Tanya and I work closely together in the diagnosis of breast cancer, and I got to tell you, she's the best.
Even when I'm tired?
Even when you're tired. I sent a nervous Nellie to her the other day, and she's so sweet, she took her right in. Tanya, I appreciate you being here, as I know you recently took on the role of medical director of breast imaging. Breast imaging diagnostics?
Yeah, breast imaging diagnostics center.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Busy enough being a diagnostic radiologist, now add medical director. Congratulations, though.
Thank you.
And can you tell us what diagnostic breast imaging is?
So diagnostic breast imaging is radiology. It's mammography, ultrasonography of the breast, and also breast MRI. So it's a combination of all those. And then sometimes we have other imaging modalities like molecular breast imaging. Sometimes we'll do CT, but mostly it's just mammography, ultrasonography, and MRI.
So I don't remember if you folks in Radioland remember, but I'm actually a breast pathologist. So, Tanya does a biopsy, I read it, I call her up, And I say, you know, I'm going in this direction. And she says, you know, we were going in this direction. And we come together. In fact, we do it frequently.
All the
time.
We
did it last week.
Exactly.
We also have Crystal Wanunu, a medical student at the UT McGovern Medical Center here in Houston, and the vice president of the Student National Medical Association. Crystal, welcome. I know a medical student's life is very busy, also a medical student who has an exam on Friday. So I appreciate you coming also.
Yes, I'm really excited to be here with you, Mary. Thank you for the invitation.
And tell us, what is the Student National Medical Association?
Well, Student National Medical Association, it's also called SNMA, it's an organization that strives to bring awareness to the underrepresented minorities in medicine, such as me, an African-American female medical student, and also to bring awareness to the local health disparities that occur within our counties and the city as a whole. And this organization is really great in that it brings, if you feel underrepresented, if you feel like you're an underrepresented minority in medicine, or if you're not and you want to be an advocate or want to gain understanding, it's a great org for you to do so. And I think what I love truly about it is that one of its goals is to create culturally competent physicians, which I think is very important in this vast diversity population and the patients that we're going to serve. And I'm so excited to be a part of an org that's going to better equip me to serve the patients that I am excited to be a part of.
Beautiful statement.
Exactly. Can you believe I was a member of the Student National Medical Association just a few years ago? I used to be president of the Student National Medical Association at the University of Iowa College of Medicine many years ago.
Wow. So this is like a 6 degrees of separation.
Always. That's life. That is life.
So beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. So everybody out there, you know I have the right people on board. Okay. So, just a little more background about tonight. Men have been physicians since time immemorial, I have to tell y'all. I thought that was time immemorium. And then I said, make sure I'm going to spell this right. Even though nobody's going to see my script, I want to know that it's spelled right. I'm a little OCD. And I went and looked it up, and it's not time immemorium. It's time immemorial, meaning going back to the beginning of time. Now, our oath upon graduation was, in fact, written by the Greek physician Hippocrates sometime between the 3rd and 5th century B.C. So we know men were physicians back then, white men. Historically, there were also female Greek physicians, but by the time of the Middle Ages, with the domination of the Western world by the male-led Roman Catholic Church, women were discouraged from the practice of medicine. Well, let's move up to a couple hundred years ago. Here in the United States, physicians were not only men, pretty much all men, but they were all white men until about the mid-19th century. Black men were not allowed to attend medical school in the southern United States at that time. And even in the north, many schools were closed to African-American men. We're really talking about pre-Civil War. In 1847, Rush Medical School in Chicago graduated the first American-trained African-American physician, David J. Peck. 2 years later, the first white female in the United States, Elizabeth Blackwell, graduated from the Geneva Medical College in New York. So that's 1849. It took slightly more than a decade for the first black woman physician in the United States to graduate. And she was Rebecca Lee Crumpler. Rebecca was born in 1831 in Delaware, and in 1864, she graduated from the New England Female Medical College in Boston. The school had opened in 1848 specifically to teach medicine to women. Crystal, can you tell us the story of Rebecca's life? I know we don't know a whole lot, but if you could give us her biography, that would be great.
Yeah. Rebecca Crumpler, she was born as Rebecca Davis to Matilda Weber and Absalom Davis in 1831 in Christiana, Delaware. Rebecca was noticed as particularly a bright student when she was young, and she attended the elite West Newton, England, and classical school in Massachusetts, where she was a special student in mathematics. This is quite remarkable, considering slavery was still legal all across the southern United States, and education for women, much less an African-American woman, was not encouraged. She moved to Charleston, Mass. In 1852, just 21 years old then. During the same year, 1852, she met and married Wyatt Lee, a former slave from Virginia living in Mass. For the next 8 years, she worked as a nurse. You have to remember that nursing was largely learned by practical experience. The first professional nursing school did not open until 1873. Several years went by, and she applied to the New England Female Medical College in 1860. She was accepted with a tuition award paid for by the abolitionist Benjamin Wade. To set the stage, slavery is still ongoing in the South. In fact, she married a former slave. Abolition of slavery has become an important issue in the North, and Abraham Lincoln has just been elected president. The country was on the verge of the Civil War. There was also a feminist movement that was popular in the North during this period. At that time, there were just under 55,000 physicians in the United States, of which only 300 were female, and none of these women were black. On March 1, 1864, the Board of Trustees of the New England Female Medical College voted to name Rebecca Lee, she was married by then, a doctor of medicine. This is a remarkable milestone in black history. Her husband, Wyatt Lee, had died of tuberculosis in 1863, while she was still a medical student. Dr. Lee first practiced medicine in Boston, primarily treating poor women and children. She married Arthur Crumpler in 1865. He was a former fugitive slave from Virginia. He had served in the Union Army as a blacksmith. In Mass, he had been taken in by Nathaniel Allen, the founder of the West Newton English and Classical School, which is where Rebecca had studied as a young woman. After the Civil War ended in 1865, she moved to Richmond, Virginia. By 1869, she had returned to Boston. She had a daughter, Lizzie Sinclair Crumpler, in 1870. It seems that she practiced until about 1880, and in 1883 she wrote and published A Book of Medical Discourses, which she described as a book to advise women on medical care for themselves and their children. She died in 1895 at the age of 64. So let's hear her life in her own words from the opening chapter of A Book of Medical Discourses.
Okay, I'm going to pull up that book. I do want to tell you that as we talk about her, we need to remember what the state of medicine was at that time. There were no antibiotics. People didn't believe in bacteria. People didn't believe in these kinds of causes, or that there were particular causes that came from the air. People believed that your diseases came from the humors or from the cold and so on. And it's a very different viewpoint when you actually read what she says. So I'm going to get it in just a moment. Do you remember some of her dialogue? Well, not so much dialogue.
I got it.
I took some screenshots, and I just need to get my computer.
The power of a Mac.
The power of a Mac, and the dependence upon computers, which is... Okay, here we go. There's the first page. That looks readable. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So I'm going to go ahead and continue on with the introduction from her book.
And this is written by her.
Yes.
So this introduction is a little bit autobiographical.
Yes, in her own personal words. I now present to the public a few thoughts in book form, trusting that they will be accepted on their merits alone. The following pages contain a few simple appeals to common sense and are addressed to mothers, nurses, and women generally. All honor is due to a far-seeing legislation, which has recognized the importance of fitting women for the great and natural office of nurse or doctress of medicine.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Isn't it nice that she says nurse or doctress? I mean, yes. Even when I was growing up and I told people I wanted to be a doctor, you know what they said? Oh, you mean a nurse. So it's great that she says that. I think that's an important message from her. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, I interrupted.
You're good. And I even love just the doctress in general. I wonder why that fell off in history. I think that's beautiful. I would love to be a doctress of medicine.
Well, okay, I'm going to interrupt you one more time. I'm really bad about that. But.
No.
I grew up in Stark County, where most of the population learns English as a second language. And when I go down there, they call me Doctoressa, which I just love. So this is like doctress, but
that's
go on.
Beautiful.
So I get it. I get it, yeah.
And I'll continue on with her introduction. Or by it facilitates BITES facilities are offered to each member of a community for the promotion of Christian enlightenment. By frequent visits through various parts of the United States at all seasons of the year, as well by quite an extensive community, while in the capacity of family nurse and subsequent practitioner, I have become quite familiar with those ailments and diseases which afflict many infants from birth to the close of the teething period, or till after the fifth year of their age. It may be well to state here that having been reared by a kind aunt in Pennsylvania, whose usefulness with the sick was continually sought, I early conceived a liking for and sought every opportunity to be in a position to relieve the suffering of others. Later in life, I devoted my time, when best I could, to nursing as a business, serving under different doctors for a period of 8 years, from 1852 to 1860. Most of the time, at my adopted home in Charleston, Middlesex County, Mass. From these doctors, I received letters commending me to the faculty of the New England Female Medical College, whence 4 years afterward, I received the degree of Doctoress of Medicine. I then practiced in Boston, but desiring a larger scope for general information, I traveled toward the British Dominions. On my return, after the close of the Confederate War, my mind centered upon Richmond, the capital city of Virginia, as the proper field for real missionary work, and one that would present ample opportunities to become acquainted with the diseases of women and children. During my stay, there nearly every hour was improved in the sphere of labor. The last quarter of the year, in 1866, I was enabled through the agency of the borough under General Brown to have access each day to a very large number of indigenous and other different classes in a population of over 30,000 colored. At the close of my services in that city, I returned to my former home, Boston, where I entered into work with renewed vigor, practicing outside and receiving children in the house for treatment, regardless in a measure of remuneration. Although not now in a locality where my constant attendance is required, I do not fail to notice the various published records of the condition of the health of Boston and vicinity. That women should study the mechanism of the human structure to better enable her to protect life before assuming the office of a nurse, few will agree. But that good services have been performed by those who were entirely ignorant of it, everyone must admit. In my own experience, there was much that to me was obscure, yet strange to say. I never met with an accident. A kind father directed every thought in behalf of helpless. I believe matrimony to be a divine institution, and that the results arising from a union of the sexes should be considered an important study for each party considered. If we as intelligent beings sit still in this matter of physical security, premature decay must take the place of perfection. Since I have, with no small degree of diffidence, consented to submit my long-kept journal to the public in the form of a book, I desire to present the different subjects by the use of as few technical terms as possible, and to make my statements brief, simple, and comprehensive. Indeed, I desire that my book shall be a primary reader for the hands of every woman, and yet nonetheless suited to any who may be conservant with all branches of medical science. If women are permitted to read and reflect for themselves, it is hardly possible that they will say it is uninteresting to them, or that it should only be read by men. In dealing with subjects that bring to mind thousands of premature mortalities, as for instance those for cholera infantum or pneumonia, I deem it expedient to speak only of what I know and to which I can testify. I have endeavored to give some domestic or readily palliative reliefs for the several cases described, thereby hoping to avoid the possibility of a remedies being applied without an acquaintance with the character of phases of the complaint for which it is intended. There is no doubt that thousands of little ones annually die at our very doors from diseases which could have been prevented or cut shortly by timely aid. People do not wish to feel that death ensues through neglect of their past. Indeed, they speak on consumption, cholera infantum, diphtheria, etc., as if sent by God to destroy our infants. They seem to forget that there is a cause for every ailment, and that it may be in the power to remove it. My chief desire in presenting this book is to impress upon somebody's mind the possibilities of prevention.
Isn't that amazing? So we think that preventive medicine is a modern field of medicine. And here she is in the 1860s talking about preventive medicine, talking about women empowering themselves, talking about causes of diseases.
Yeah, it's remarkable. She was well ahead of her time and so clear in her thoughts and in her purpose.
And she says, I'm writing this in a language for the layperson because I want you to know how to take better care of your family to prevent death. So I have to read to you something to discuss. Henry Louis Gates and Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham are both professors of African-American history at Harvard. And in fact, you may remember Henry Louis Gates is the friend of a Barack Obama who had a skirmish with the Cambridge, Massachusetts police while entering his home, and he was arrested. Wrongly so, certainly. But this led to what was called the Beer Summit, wherein President Barack Obama invited Gates and the arresting officer to the White House for a beer. Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham is a professor of African American history at Harvard also. And of course, they are both African American. And they wrote a book called African American Lives. And I want to quote on what they said about Rebecca Crumpler. On 24 February 1864, Crumpler and her two white classmates, Mary Lockwood Allen and Elizabeth Kimball, came before the four faculty members to undergo their final oral examinations. Each candidate had had at least 3 years of preparatory coursework, written a thesis, and paid her graduation fees, all standard for the time. At the conclusion of the exam, the faculty voted to recommend Crumpler and her two classmates to the Board of Trustees, but they recorded some hesitation with respect to Crumpler's recommendation. Quote, deficiencies in Crumpler's education and what the faculty regarded as her, quote, slow progress in medical school led the faculty to note that, quote, some of us have hesitated very seriously in recommending her. In spite of their reservations, the faculty deferred to, quote, the wishes of the trustees and the present state of public feeling. Suggesting, and now this is these are the author's opinions, Gates and Higginbotham, suggesting that the faculty had felt pressured to pass Crumpler. I mean, they literally wrote this into the book. The minutes of that meeting offer no further explanation. It is possible that doctors for whom Crumpler had worked before medical school had put pressure on the faculty. Nevertheless, on 1 March, the trustees conferred the Doctoress of Medicine degree upon Crumpler, whom the trustees identified as Mrs. Rebecca Lee, Negress. Now, a little further on in the section they have on her, they commented on her book, which you just heard the introduction to, and they described it as proof that, quote, she viewed her medical training primarily as preparation for her nursing work. Okay, ladies, I was offended by this. I thought this was a young woman who broke barriers, who worked in what we would today call a vocational nurse's field. Well, nurse, I mean, she worked to the fullest extent that a nurse worked. There was no professional training. She went to medical school, and they interpret these comments and give
They interpreted the comments negatively, and of course, you know, I'm always of the thought that everyone has their own opinion, that, you know, and they can certainly have their opinion, but I would suggest to them that it has been shown in several studies that African American students may receive a lower mark than their non-black colleagues, even when they're performing at a high level. So when I was reading the thoughts or the words about her deficiencies, quote unquote, and her slow progress, quote unquote, I wondered if at that time that perhaps some of that phenomenon was taking place, and perhaps that was, you know, what was going on, that she wasn't in fact slow or deficient, that it was just that
she
phenomenon.
Was black.
Yeah.
She was black.
Yeah.
She was different. She was different.
Yeah. She was different. And also, I would also argue with them as well that in her book, it didn't say nursing. It said nursing and doctress. So it was very clear. Her purpose was quite clear as to what her plans were for the book.
Thank you, Tanya, because I took great umbrance with that, which is why I brought it here. Crystal, did you want to say something about it?
Yeah, I kind of my take on it was it was something of, I feel like I turned it into a positive when I take a step back and realize that during that time, especially since it was the time of slavery, it was illegal to teach an African American to read or write, and for her to be able to matriculate in the female college of medicine, and kind of learning upon doing my research too, that not all, about one third of the class graduated.
Right.
So I think it was amazing that kind of just out of those group of women, she was a part of that one third that not even all of them were able to graduate. And still there's a way to discredit, when I see it as perseverance, that she can come from a background of where it's illegal to even know to seek or have education and still persevere and still excel is amazing to see.
Oh, thank you.
As I thought about her, so many students of today have the, I want to say complaint or excuse for some, that I've never seen anyone do this or I've never seen anyone do that. She didn't see anybody do
no,
it.
No, she didn't.
And that wasn't a problem for her. So if there are any young people out there listening or parents of young people, I would encourage you not to worry about not having seen someone do something, but instead take it upon yourself and be the first one to do it. You don't need anything but your dream, your vision, and then just move ahead with that and make it happen and do it for somebody else. Like this wonderful, bright, talented, smart, courageous woman did.
That was beautifully said. And when you say smart, courageous, you know, what we read of earlier in the biography was that she wanted to go to the newly liberated South, mm-hmm. and treat people who were now in, who had come from one position of
destitute.
Being, yes.
Beyond
well, from
destitute.
The position, so the, yeah. Beyond destitute.
Exactly.
The position of slavery.
Exactly.
Completely dependent upon your owner to see yeah. you as a piece of value, mm-hmm. to one where, what was your job market and what were your skills and who mm-hmm. was going to pay you? And she mm-hmm. went down there as a female physician while the Ku Klux Klan was active. So I'm glad, you know, I found that biography of her, and I thought that, and then of course the part of, oh well, by her book, she really just wants to be a nurse.
That was disappointing.
Yes,
actually,
because
very disappointing.
What she wrote, and Crystal and I looked through her book, and what mm-hmm. she wrote about medicine was what the state of knowledge of medicine was at the time.
Exactly.
She was, you know, but she was just putting it in.
She was spot on. She actually had the wisdom and also the intelligence to put it at a level where a layperson could understand. And a lot of times the problem with academicians is they aren't able to come down to a level where someone without the knowledge can understand. And so she was able to bridge that gap, which I think makes her even more incredible.
Absolutely. And then the concept of prevention. So I have to tell you, yeah. I don't think I've ever shown it to you, Tanya, but I wrote this little book because people would call me and ask me for help on medicine. So I call it A Pocket Guide to Cancer. It's not a technical book. It's this is what this means. This is what this means. This is mm-hmm. what your pathology report means. And if somebody picked that up and said, oh, I guess you're a nurse, I think I would be quite insulted. Mm-hmm. So I hold Rebecca Lee Crumpler up there
Me
in
too.
My mind.
Me too.
All right. Well, we're going to go back to the backstage there. Nicole, what did you think of this?
Well, I definitely, I can understand everyone's point of views, but I definitely agree with Crystal as well as Tanya about, although she had to come up to par, she wasn't taught like everyone else. She still made a way. So I just appreciate that she had to go and change her mindset, which that's how things start. You have to change your mindset and know that if you're going to do something, first you have to set your mind properly to do it so that you can execute the task. So regardless of if she went for a physician and just really wanted to be a nurse, she still accomplished more than most women did during that time, especially for in the African-American society.
She accomplished more than most women. Let me underline that. She accomplished more than most women, underline that, of all the population of women in the United States, and then add to that that she was African-American.
So, I mean, I appreciate that. And just looking at all things, there are negatives and positives to everything, but when you're having to pull something, what is the value and the lesson that we learned out of is that she persevered. And that's what I pulled from that mostly.
So I have to say here, we are here on So What's Your Story? Broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Or live streaming from kpft.org. Sorry, Hank, but I just have to say this every time. They can get it in the space station. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. So, Hank, I think you told
me Mary.
That we are referred to as the Storytellers Mafia. What's that?
Mary, ask me that one more time, because Nicole is hogging the microphone and the earphones, trying to make a fool out of myself.
Okay. Hank, you're in a room with a bunch of women and a bunch of African-American women.
Yes.
And you're just a white guy out there.
I know. Tell me about it. Story of my life. But it's okay. It's a good part of my life.
Okay.
These are great people.
So true or not true that our team is called the Storytellers Mafia?
They are, and it's kind of an interesting story. If you have about 1 minute, I'll tell you about it. And actually, you know the person who began this adage.
And he's been on this show.
Yes, Paul Topekian. One time, he came up behind me and he says, "So you're the storytelling mafia." I said, "Why do you say that?" He said, "Because I just heard you turn to Greg and say, 'Go get her over there. She's a really good teller. Go get her.'" I said, "Well, that's because I have a bad voice tonight." He says, "I know, but you sound like Marlon Brando." And I said, "And that's the reason why you call us the storytelling mafia?" He says, "No. Actually, the real reason is that every time we look over to you, you're sitting next to Greg, and you're always nudging him, and you're giving him the okay to go ambush somebody who's coming off the stage or not. It's as if you're saying, go get that person or go hit that person or one of the two. It's like you're giving an order." And I just found that to be pretty funny. And he said, "Yeah, you guys are known as the storytelling mafia. In other words, if you got to make it, you got to go talk to those guys."
Oh,
so it's kind of an innocent little story. But yes, it's sort of stuck. And it's a story that you hear around the moth. So, that's where we come from.
That's cool, actually.
Yeah.
I think I can still use that word.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Okay. I know that even though we are the only live radio storytelling show, there are other storytelling venues in our community. So, Nicole and Tatiana, can you tell us about some of these?
There are.
I know. No, it's us. I mean, we're the mafia. We, if you want a storyteller, you come to us. You dial in to
us.
So What's Your Story? Well, live streaming or the podcast.
Yeah,
you don't come here, you don't make it.
Well, let me just first say about our show. If, you don't have radio, it's no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us live streaming on kpft.org or with Facebook Live or on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and YouTube channel. But yes, there are some other important storytelling venues in and around town. So let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, and that's at 1500 Sunset. Or you can go to their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all our past So What's Your Story programs, and that's every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program. And we don't want to forget our friends at the Moth. They're at Warehouse Live the second Tuesdays of the month, and the theme this month was Love Hurts, and it does sometimes. And next month it will be Test on March 13th. Yes, just in time for midterms. Oh my gosh. Crystal.
As if you guys really know how to handle that.
We're holding on, right. Dr. Hank. We're holding on. Mm-hmm. Now, Crystal, you have an upcoming test. Maybe you can turn and tune into that story.
I will definitely do that.
Well, check it out, girl. I'm going to listen too. So remember, you can get those past shows at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Check out our program clips on YouTube again, and tell us what you think about our shows. Suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise we will get back with you if you're nice. but most importantly, please be sure to share our page with your friends. And oh yes, we love it if you like us before you leave.
Hey, Nicole, what's happening next Wednesday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT 90.1?
Well, you know, Mary, next week, Hank. Yes, I said it. Hank, the mafia boss, will host a special group of guests who always rise the bar and bring in listeners. These are students from Meyerland Performing and Visual Arts Middle School, formerly Johnston Middle School. It also will be the first week of KPFT's Fun Drive, and there's no better group of tellers to show you what you're paying for than these brilliant creative kids.
Oh, thank you, Nicole. I always love hearing the upcoming generation of storytellers. Speaking of brilliant, let's resume with stories about African-American women physicians on this last day of Black History Month. As you listeners in Radioland might have noticed, Dr. Crumpler was a physician who treated women and children. In fact, throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, women physicians were largely the treating physicians for women and children. Even though there was great opposition to having females operate, the second female in the U.S. after Elizabeth Blackwell, she was the second female because Rebecca Crumpler hadn't graduated yet. This was Dr. Mary Edwards Walker. She graduated in 1955, and she began a practice as a surgeon with her husband. Response was lukewarm, and the practice failed, although she is later recognized in 1863 as a U.S. Army surgeon. 1863, this is about the same time that Rebecca Crumpler becomes the first African-American female physician. So we have our first African-American female physician and our first white female surgeon. But it took almost another century for an African-American female to be trained and recognized as a surgeon. Crystal, do you want to tell us the story of Dorothy Lavinia Brown?
Will do. Dorothy Lavinia Brown was born in Philadelphia to a single mother on January 17, 1919. At the age of 5 months, she was placed in an orphanage in Troy, New York. While at the orphanage, she underwent a tonsillectomy and became fascinated by medicine. When she was about 12, her mother retrieved her, but Dorothy and she did not get along, and Dorothy kept running away from home. Dorothy became a mother's helper for a while and also worked as a self-service laundry. She was taken in by foster parents Samuel and Lola Remden, and she continued her education. After graduating from Troy High School, she worked as a domestic helper and attended Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina. In 1941, she graduated from college and became an inspector for a defense plant in Troy. She never lost her interest in medicine. Sparked by the tonsillectomy, and in 1944, she entered the Meharry Medical College in Nashville. Meharry is interesting, as it was one of the historically Black medical colleges in the U.S. Until 1964, and the passage of the Civil Rights Act, medical colleges were legally able to exclude Black men. The historically Black colleges and universities were established across the U.S. to provide higher education to African Americans. historically black medical colleges followed suit. Meharry was officially founded in 1876 as the medical department of Central Tennessee College. In 1915, it officially became Meharry Medical College. Dorothy Lavinia Brown graduated from Meharry in 1948 and became a surgery resident at the Hubbard Hospital of Meharry in 1949. There was great opposition to having a female surgery resident, but she convinced the then chief surgeon, Matthew Walker. Dr. Brown completed her residency in 1954. She had a long career as a surgeon and a politician. She was the chief of surgery at the new defunct Riverside Hospital in Nashville from 1957 to 1983. During that time, she was the first African-American female to be elected to the Tennessee State Legislature, serving from 1966 to 1968. Notably pertinent to tonight, she was involved in the passing of the Negro History Act that required public schools in Tennessee to conduct special programs during Negro History Week. Yay, Dr. Brown! We do celebrate now during this National Black History Month. Dr. Brown also succeeded in having abortions legalized in the case of rape and incest, and in expanding the already existing legally permitted abortion in cases where the mother's life was endangered. This position, however, cost her the election in 1968, during which she ran for the Tennessee State Senate. She returned to being a full-time surgeon at the Riverside Hospital. She also was an attending surgeon at the George W. Hubbard and General Hospitals, a surgery professor at Meharry, and the director for the clinical rotation for medical students at Riverside and Meharry Hospitals. Dr. Brown never married. She adopted a daughter in 1956 from a single mother. The story is that the mother begged Dorothy to adopt her daughter, as she did not have the means, and she knew that Dorothy would be a great mother. Dorothy named her daughter Lola Denise Brown in honor of her foster mother. Dorothy is also recognized as the first single female in Tennessee to legally adopt a child. And a final first, she was the first African-American female to become a fellow of the American College of Surgeons in 1959, and the third woman. She died in 2004 at the age of 85.
I listened to her life story and I feel like tears of force. And I have to tell you, I'm a white woman, but as a woman who's been in a man's field, I started in physics and then went into medicine. I often experience what I like to call female subtraction vision, mm-hmm. You know, where the male surgeon comes in and sees me and another pathologist there. He's a guy, I'm a woman. And he immediately walks over to the guy and says, oh, so you're the one doing frozens today. And the guy has to point and say, no, she is. And he looks at me. He's never even seen me. I read about Dorothy Lavinia Brown, and I don't think anybody could subtract her from their vision. And so when I hear about a woman like that, I want to be like that. I want to be somebody that can't be subtracted. Tanya, I have to tell you, I noticed that about you the first time we were at a clinical management conference. I said, that woman will never be subtracted from anybody's vision. I'm going to follow her and be like her.
You aren't ever subtracted either, my friend. No, you are not. But yes, that's very true. You know, she was a force to be reckoned with.
This kid was in an orphanage. She was a runaway.
Exactly.
She works for herself. Mm-hmm. She loves her foster parents because she names her daughter after her. But she breaks surgical barriers, political barriers.
Exactly.
Adoption barriers.
Yes. Abortion barriers.
Abortion barriers. She's willing to bring up the topic. Yeah.
She's willing to just go after it.
Yes.
I think without fear.
Mm-hmm. And I think what I also notice and admire is that sometimes, as I'm seeing with these female physicians, is that they bring awareness to the causes of abortion and female care that I think gets neglected when it's malely dominated.
Oh.
So that's what I'm noticing with these historical and wonderful women, is that they're making differences in female health and female in medicine as their presence and the growth and advancement of just the general medicine in female.
So you guys know me. I tend to the political. And I'm on Facebook, and somebody passed something by that's something where somebody says, if you don't know anything about guns, you can't say anything about it. And an Earth person says, and all those men in Congress are deciding on what women are going to do with their bodies? Do they even know what a vagina looks like? The anatomy of a vagina. So, and I just thought, this is great. Yeah. And so we have all these men who know nothing. And then you come across this woman who just barreled past them.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Mm-hmm. I love that. And actually, we know some surgeons at MD Anderson. You hosted Dr. Valerie Lewis recently.
Yes. My organization that I spoke of earlier, SNMA, we had a Black History Month program at our school. And Dr. Valerie Lewis was our keynote speaker. And she honestly exudes such confidence and is breaking barriers herself as the first department chair of orthopedic oncology at her department in MD Anderson. And just her presence herself is just exuberates confidence. And it's just such a great feeling to be around someone like that and to hear her words. And she spoke about the history of medicine and the African-American advancement, which is what we're speaking on as well. And just seeing the growth and how high and how far the African-American culture has come in medicine. It's just beautiful to be around that and to learn from such an intelligent woman.
Yeah, she's really great. Since I do surgical pathology, although she's bone and soft tissue and I'm breast, she's occasionally in the surgical pathology suites with her specimens while I'm doing some breast specimens. And it's just great to look at her. There's this space around her that says, yes, what do you need? What do you want? And I love it. Oh, so one of the things I was thinking about that we might discuss is Meharry. Meharry was a historically Black medical college. So what's up with the historically Black colleges? And you told us a little bit about where they came from. Do you want to say anything else about them?
From my knowledge, I know a lot of, I think about Howard, I think about Prairie View A&M, I think about Meharry when it comes to historically Black colleges and universities as a way for African Americans to achieve education when they weren't being accepted into the colleges in the South or in the North. They made a way and said, we're going to make our own way of education. And if you guys don't want to teach us, we'll find a way. And I think some through legal issues, some hospitals and schools weren't able to stand. And the last standing are, I believe, is Howard and Meharry. They produce such intelligent and confident physicians. And I see the legacy continuing on from the 1800s. It's amazing.
Yeah, I attended a historically Black college for undergraduate school. I went to Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi, a small private school. And so the experience there is different. It's predominantly African-American, and so it's a bit like learning in a family. And also, it's very cultural as well. So it's a different kind of experience, you know, much different for me at the time that I attended college because there were choices. I could go to any college that I wanted to go to, but I chose to go to a predominantly Black school, whereas the people in the 1800s, that was pretty much their only choice. Mm-hmm. So it's wonderful that there are so many choices for students these days. So for medical school, I applied to Meharry and was accepted, also to Howard, and was accepted. Charles Drew was also the third historically Black medical school at that time. So all three, and I was accepted, but I chose to go to the University of Iowa in Iowa City.
Hey, you're a radiologist, but I know they have a great pathology department.
They do.
And that's the basis of medicine. So if they have good pathology, they have good medicine.
So it was great. And then, you know, for residency, I went to Mayo Clinic. So certainly for historically Black universities, it's a wonderful experience, I think, for students. So if we think like here in, you know, in this Houston area, there's TSU, so and then there's also, as you mentioned, Prairie View A&M. So, yeah, lots of opportunities for students here.
So here I am. I'm white, so I went to the University of Texas at Austin. And I am Mexican-American, but I know it's the radio. But if you looked at me, I have about 2 melanocytes in my body. You would never know. I mean, I'm a fraction Mexican-American. I grew up in a community that was 97% Hispanic. So I identify with the Hispanic culture. So I must say, when I got up to Austin, I missed certain things. I was, and, you know, white people will get together and they'll say, they'll make some racist joke and it'll be like, it's okay because it's just us together. And it's like, I don't think so. I'm Mexican. Mm-hmm. I'm not dumb, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but I don't think I ever really experienced that sense of being the only person of my color in a group ever until I went to Africa. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I like to think I'm colorblind, but you do notice that I'm the only white person and everybody else here, you know, and it's not that it's just something that your body says, hey, I notice. So I then began to empathize with African-Americans in going into colleges and so on that were predominantly white. There's just a sense of something that you notice. Mm-hmm. Wow, we are getting closer and closer to the end of the hour. This has gone by fast. This is Mary Edgerton with Nicole Rochelin and Tatiana Gago, and our guests, Dr. Tanya Mosley and medical student Crystal Wanunu, telling life stories about African-American female physicians on this, the last day of Black History Month. I did bring a poem written by one of my favorite poets. And, of course, somebody had to read to me her poem when she reached the age of 50, or an interview with her when she reached the age of 50, when I turned 50.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. Okay. Crystal, you're an up-and-coming doctor. This is called Phenomenal Woman. It's a poem by Maya Angelou. You want to read it for us?
Yeah. Phenomenal Woman. Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I am a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That is me. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man, the fellow stands or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes, and the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist, and the joy in my feet. I am a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. What they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. When I try to show them, they say they can't see. I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ridge of my breasts, the grace of my style. I am a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's me. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need of my care, 'cause I am a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's me.
I love that poem.
Well, me too.
Beautiful.
Okay, and you two are phenomenal women in medicine. No doubt about it. So are you, Mary.
So are you.
No, it's such an honor to be around two phenomenal physicians who are just real big mentors, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, that's great.
It's our pleasure.
You'll be up there.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we are counting down. It's the last day of Black History Month. I liked that poem to end that. It speaks to the phenomenal women that we learned the stories of tonight and who stand as examples to everybody, mm-hmm. and your own experiences that you spoke about. Now, we're going to sign off, and I have my own little signature sign off, and I ask y'all one by one, want to say anything to anybody in Radio Land tonight? Tanya?
Just good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night and pleasant dreams.
Okay. It's like good night, moon.
You know it.
And Crystal?
Well, I'd like to say hey to my family, the Wanunu clan, my Bible study group, and my sorority sisters, my support, my best friends. Y'all are awesome.
Which sorority?
Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated.
I'm an AKA.
Oh my gosh, how awesome!
Okay. Oh, I don't know. It was 6 degrees a little earlier because they were both Student National Medical Association, and now they're both same sorority.
I've been
an AKA since 1987.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful. Long time.
Wow. Oh, yeah. That's great. Well, I'm glad I got y'all connected.
Yes.
That's
okay. All right. Don't dare move out there. We've got Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger ready in the wings to share some cool classics. I see Wild Bill right over there pulling out those vinyls. You're not Wild Bill? You look wild enough to be Bill.
That's pretty funny.
Or is it that, dare I say this, every white guy with a beard looks the same to me at night?
Oh.
I didn't say that.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Oh, God, girls, I treasured this tonight.
Yeah,
I treasured this
too.
Tonight. And, you know, I go and I get the podcast, and I listen to it when I get home because it feels so good to listen to it from the listening point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So go to that website. So keep loving those great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, along with my guests, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD3 stream. New and improved, get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming. created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD3. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT Houston.
Today is February 28th, and on this day in 1932, inventor Richard Spikes received a patent for an automatic gear shift device for automobiles and other motor vehicles. Spike also patented a pressure-dispensed beer tapper, which was purchased by the Milwaukee Brewing Company. Other patented inventions include a safety brake system, transmission, billiard cue rack, and a pantograph.
You are listening to KPFT Houston. Hello!